Welcome to the epicenter of sports and entertainment. This is the Root Dog Show. Now, here's your host, Rudy Reyes.
Welcome to the Root Dog Show. This is Rudy Reyes. And of course, it's been a minute. It's been a little bit. Haven't really kind of digested the new position yet at CBS, but I'm transitioning and I'm transitioning well. I'm here in Central Valley, California. But this isn't about me. Let me just make that clear. It's not about me. It's about my guest on the other side of the phone here, and that is Eric Dickerson. Fifth best running back all time. Welcome, Eric, to the show. How are you?
Good. How are you? Thank you for having me.
No problem. Thank you for coming on and spending your time. It's been a little bit because, you know, the NFL season is about to ramp up, and I'm sure that means you're going to be busy doing all kinds of things, Ram-related as well as NFL-related. And as the season approaches, Eric, it seems to be that you know, there's some problems in L.A., and not with the Rams, but with the other L.A. team, the Chargers, as Derwin James is now out to 6 to 8 months. And, of course, lots of news in the NFL. We're not going to get into too much news. But what do you make of Derwin James? Does he even see it down this year, or is he going to wait till next year, do you suspect?
You know, when you say 6 to 8 months, you're probably looking at next year. You know, the thing about Derwin James is, you know, he could be an outstanding player. I mean, really outstanding, but, you know, he's been hurt the last 2 years. And, you know, the old saying, when we came up, you can't make the club in the tub, you know, and I hate to see that for him or, you know, any player that plays in the NFL or plays any sport. But, man, he's a very good player, fun to watch play. But once again, you know, due to injury, and you hate to see it happen in training camp, you know, not even during the regular season. And that's what's happened. That's what's happened to him. You know, I guess it happened yesterday. Yesterday, a couple of days, but I just heard the news myself.
Yeah, it just seems that Derwin James has much of a nod as he had for being, you know, Defensive Player of the Year, and that's always an esteemed honor, especially in the NFL, where guys like Derwin James are basically, people are just shaking their head at right now. This guy cannot catch a break for whatever it's worth, and whatever that means for his football future. Hopefully, the Chargers stick with him throughout this, because again, this is just something that happens. You know about injury, you know all about that. You spent your time in the NFL, it's been 11 seasons. In fact, you backed up plenty of people as well as being the lead rusher in most of the teams that you've been on. When I look at this upcoming season, Eric, there's just so many things that really come into mind. You have COVID that really is playing a role in regards to how players are going to be utilizing the social distancing aspect. You know, how does training camp look? I had Dan Helley of NFL Network. We were talking about how the stands are going to look, how the stadiums are going to look. Is it going to be quarter occupancy? A lot of teams are basically saying no fans, at least in the first month of play. That's a lot of games for first month of play. What are your thoughts on that? And do you think they may cut that out a little bit earlier based on analytics?
Well, it just depends. I mean, you know, it's you know, when it comes to football, you really need to get in there and have a preseason. But, you know, right now, no, they can't. And that's important. You know, when you play a sport like football, of course, you have to be ready. I mean, and now you're talking about having to skip training camp and go and just start playing football. It makes it really tough on players, make it tough on quarterbacks, offensive line, defensive line, everything, the whole thing about it. But I really believe that, you know, not having fans in the stadium, I think, well, you know, in L.A., not going to have fans. And other cities might. I think it's the right call. I really do believe it's the right call to do because, you know, I find it hard to believe they're going to be able to finish a full season. I mean, I hope they can. I don't see it happening. But maybe some kind of way to, you know, God can work it out where it can happen, because, you know, football is the ultimate contact sport. It's the ultimate team sport where you rely on every player on the field. You know, the guys that's, you know, on the sidelines. You travel with probably, you know, not just players, a 53-man roster, but you got to think about personnel. You got to think about writers. You got to think about equipment guys, doctors, media. You're traveling with sometimes 80 to 100 people. So, I mean, it's going to be a big challenge this year, I think, for the NFL itself, you know, it's just as a whole. And think about going to the playoffs, you know, if you have playoffs and Super Bowl. I mean, will we have to play fans at the Super Bowl? I mean, I just, you know, it's so much to think about right now when it comes to the National Football League.
Yeah, especially in the NFL, when you think about other sporting leagues, and I've talked about this many, many times, where you look at the NBA and they've been able to minimize, if not completely absolve themselves of any further COVID tests at leagues like the NHL. No people reported as having COVID. So it just kind of makes you wonder, is the bubbling gonna, I don't know, come to a bust? Do you think the NFL may convert to a bubble type system? Is that even possible?
It's not impossible. It's impossible because, I mean, how could you put a bubble around that many players on a team or teams and have them play in one spot the whole time and confine that many guys? I mean, you'd have to take over the whole town. I mean, almost a whole next to that town, because you can take up a city, you take up a whole small town basically
Yeah,
to put it right in
no,
a
and
bubble.
I know a lot of teams do that, especially when you look at a team like the Steelers, who go into and basically occupy a good wing of St. Vincent there in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, where these guys are staying in dorms, they're building the camaraderie, they're building the familiarity. I think something like that in some type of college-esque environment where they're complete solitude, and not touching fans, not autographing anything, no. Almost like a no-touch policy of any kind whatsoever. No high fives, none of that stuff. I think in that capacity, maybe in a training camp situation, that's more likely. But you don't see it that way? You don't think that that could actually work?
No. Training camp, yeah, because you kind of stuck in your area. Well, I don't know. I guess some teams are doing it. Some teams letting guys go home, stay at home and do it. But most of the time, you're stuck in that area. Like in we were in Cal State Fullerton when I was in the Rams. You know, and you right there. You know, with the guys. You know, 24/7. But during the regular season, it's impossible. I mean, you can't ask young men, young players. You can, but they're not going to do it. I mean, just like when you're 22, 23 years old, you're in the National Football League, you want to have some kind of life, social life. I mean, you know, you want to be around girls. The girls want to see the guys. I mean, it's not going to happen. I mean, I can tell you it's not, it's impossible to control a 20-some-year-old young man for basically 16 weeks, or possibly what, maybe 18 or 19 weeks of an NFL season. Can't happen. It ain't
Yeah,
going to happen.
I think nowadays with social media and everybody being so much more aware of what's going on. I mean, the NFL draft was canceled. I was an hour outside of Las Vegas when I did get the news, in fact, that it was going to be canceled. It was going to be done virtually. And so you kind of suspect and look at that and say, oh my gosh, is this the future's past, you know, coming to surface? And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. It went to a virtual draft. Roger Goodell was in the basement, calling his basement at his home, calling multiple picks. I can't even imagine the type of elaborate setup they had to have from a technology standpoint, and allowing him for him to even be able to do that. And then the commentary on NFL Network only, and it was very, very little. And things were getting kind of back in the swing of things. Steve Wyche of NFL Network, who me and him are connected, he basically was there for the first time in a long time at the NFL Network studios. I think it was in Los Angeles. And I just thought to myself, wow, you know, to actually be on set in a place where you have been told you can't go in, you can't hang out in, you can't, you know, we'll call you. Don't call out, we'll call you. If you're available to
You're pretty
go
much
in.
right.
Do you see this as being, do you see fans at all being in any of these stadiums as the season progresses?
Well, I'm hearing, you know, some stadiums are going to allow fans. I think I heard Kansas City, the Chiefs are going to allow some fans. I think up to maybe, I don't know, 18 to 20,000 fans in their stadium. The Cowboys, I heard a state going to allow fans in their stadium. I know we're not going to allow any fans in our new stadium at all. And that stadium is gorgeous. But it just depends. I mean, I think each individual city is different. I mean, you know, because each governor and then their city is doing it different. So it just depends on, you know, where you are and how it plays out. I mean, I feel like if some one or some players get sick, it's going to be a major problem. I mean, it's going to be a problem. Or some fans get sick. And, you know, you don't want to see anyone actually, you know, get sick and die or nothing like that. Because if that happens, then you got a whole nother, you got a whole nother problem.
Right. And I think teams in those respective cities are going to basically make their case and say, look, the analytics support having more fans in here if overall the city's down 5.5% or point, you know, whatever the actual percentile breaks down to. But I think that, again, and I completely agree with you, I think each city, each state, each one of those stadiums, and yes, the Rams Stadium is one beautiful stadium, absolutely amazing. And I kind of want to segue into this real quick, and then I want to talk about your career. When you look at what's going on in the NBA, when you look at what's going on culturally, societally, around this country right now, with people just needing to come together, what do you believe has to change? What types of actions are going to need to be taken in order to get things back on track, to give equality that's been preached and talked about by Martin Luther King? And then you have Chadwick Boseman just passed away, and there's so many people are just dropping off. What has to change in order to get things in a new normal sense by allowing people to express themselves without being in fear of law enforcement at any point?
Well, you know, I'll say this much, you know, when you're a black young man, a black kid, like, you know, we have to teach our kids different, you know, and I grew up in a small town in Texas, but still growing up in a small town, you know, my mom and dad said, look, son, you know, it's different for you. You know, you can't do what those white kids do. When you get stopped by the police, you know, just say yes, sir, and no, sir, because when they pull you over, they're going to treat you different. And that's true. And if they see you, they're going to treat you different. And it's such a true statement. Like my son, you know, I got to give better. I give you a better example. My best friend, his boys, they're in college now, but I remember his sons were turning. They were about 14 and 15 years old because they're only like a year apart. And he said, "Man, I've got to have a talk with my boys, you know, about the police." And it's amazing how, even going back to me when I was a kid, and even up to now, you know, black men and especially parents have to have a talk with their son about how to deal with police. And the white parents don't have to do that. I mean, maybe they might, but we know for sure we have to have a talk with our children, our boys, especially boys, about how to deal with the police. And, you know, and my son, he's 8, and I'm going to have that same talk with him one day about how to deal with the police. I mean, and my son, I mean, my kids are very good kids. I have an older daughter, and she's 33, and I have a granddaughter that's 5, and I have a younger daughter that's 15. But, you know, the sad part is it's different for us. And that's my mother, the woman who raised me, my great-great aunt, she said, Eric, it's different for you. It's going to be different for you, and, you know, because you're black. And, you know, you might not want to say it. You know, like my dad had a saying. He said, son, the truth is not always popular, but it is the truth. And that is just the truth that I'm stating. It's different for us. I mean, you know, and it always has been. It always will be. You know, the change, we hope it's changed. But, you know, change comes about something that you want to make change. I mean, you think about all the black guys and even white and Hispanic guys have been wrongfully accused or pulled over. You know, I just think about the ones that have been killed that they got away with. You know, they got away with. People got away with. The police officers got away with. And I'm not saying every police officer is not a bad policeman. By no means at all. But the problem with it is, if you got one bad policeman or two or three, and I believe it's more than that, it makes it bad for the police. It does. And we need the police. We do need people. We do need law and order. You got to have law and order. You just can't. You can't have stuff just running them up. But you have to have people that are good people. And you can, you how can you determine that? I mean, because, you know, we as human beings, we are inherently bad. I mean, you have to teach a young child how to be good. You don't know how to be good. He's taught that. He's taught how to. He's taught prejudice. He's taught hate. You know, he's taught that, you know, the black kids are bad, or the white kids are bad, or the Mexican kids are bad, or the Asian kids are bad. You know, you're taught that. You don't just know that. That's just how you're taught, and it becomes instilled in you. And the sad thing is, and I just never got this. I just don't understand how any race of people can look at your skin color and think I'm better than you, because I'm this color. I just really don't get that. I mean, and it still baffles me to this day, is how I'm better than you because I have white skin, or I'm better than you because I have black skin, or I'm better than you because I have brown hair, or you have blonde hair. And I say this in closing with this is that people who do believe in God, you know, a lot of people say that they believe in God and they're Christians and all that, and that's great. But when you stand before God, I don't know, you know, what God looks like. None of us do. Knows what he looks like, but I guarantee you he ain't white with blue eyes, and I guarantee he ain't black with as they would say, nappy hair. I mean, he's not Hispanic, or he might be all of the colors in one, but the people who stand before him that made these judgment calls and did the wrong things here on earth, they have to pay for it. And I just believe that. I just have a real problem with the ignorance of racism. I mean, and it's ignorance on both sides, black, white, Latino, Asian, Palestinian. It's ignorance, you know, Israeli. I just feel like it's just ignorance. I mean, I know people have done things to people to make them like not like a race of people, but you know, every person in that race is not a bad person. That's like, I've had white people do stuff to me to make me white, make me hate white people, but I'm not like that because some of my best friends are white. I mean, my best friend, they like brothers to me. And so, I mean, I just feel like I judge everyone on their merit of how you treat me. That's the way I judge. That's what I was taught, you know. And I just wish that everyone would just look at one another as human beings. We're in the human race. That's what we are. We are human beings. We're in the same. You have two eyes, two arms, two ears, a mouth, lips, teeth, every just like everyone else. I mean, yours might be a different color. Your face might be a different color. But really, that's it. And it's just sad that's how we are right now. You know, here on Earth, on the planet that God gave us, that we hate each other just because of the color of our skin.
You know, there's been I'm a man of color myself, even though I may not sound like it, right? I've gotten that a lot myself throughout my life. I was picked on, chastised, I was ridiculed growing up in school. But I recognize that it's just plain ignorance, that if somebody is going to judge you, and of course, no man is above another to actually cast that judgment, or only God can judge me. However, you do have judgment here on earth. Unfortunately, sadly, that's just the way it is. You're talking about mankind. That's the way people's perceptions are, or the perceptions are wrong. Everybody's equal on this planet. And I want to close in this myself, then I kind of move on, talk about your career and you growing up. And I believe that when you look at people at face value without casting any type of judgment based on what you believe they have done, who you believe they are, what mentality you think they have, take all that out of the equation and look at people at face value for who they are, not what they are, for who they are, because everything else will be told after that. This is Rudy Reyes on the Rude Dog Show, joined by the one, the only, Eric Dickerson. Eric, thank you so much for taking your time out. Again, it's been fantastic having you on. I want to talk about your career. I kind of want to segue into this because it was really odd to me. And I looked at a ranking of all-time best running backs, and of course, being the fifth best comes with a lot of nuanced things. We're talking shifting, moving, hip radius, athleticism, mindset, vision, focus while you're on the field. And I take nothing away from O.J. Simpson. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. I've watched film on him time and time and time and time again. And he had the speed. He was lightning. However, he's 40th all time. You're 52nd all time. I think that should be flipped and switched, to be quite honest with you. But that's me. Again, take nothing away from O.J. Simpson at all and what he had done. But you had accomplished some records that are still not broken for a rookie season. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. To kind of give people who don't know you, and if they don't, they need to crawl from under the rock that they've been under, Southern Methodist University, or SMU, noted you as an All-American. Your first round of 83 NFL draft. You played for the LA Rams, the Colts, the Raiders, the Falcons, and then cut as part of the Packers backfield. Your rushing record kind of speaks for itself in 84, but total 13,000 yards. You said in 84 you were inducted in the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 1999, And what people probably don't know, or they probably have looked it up, is that you have myopia, which is nearsightedness. This is not a common thing. I did my own research on this. There's a lot of where the light focuses on the retina instead of off. And so that causes objects to look relatively blurry. And so vision becomes an issue, especially in the running back position. How did you cope with wearing a helmet, wearing the goggles? Then you have to put the the mouthpiece on. How are you able to handle all of that? And the people that were basically copying you in the stands by wearing their own format of goggles, obviously not a prescription unless they happen to have myopia. How did you handle all of that, especially as you're going on into a season, your first season with the Rams?
Well, I'll go back to even high school, junior high. I used to wear my school glasses. You know, I didn't have sports glasses back in those days in the 70s. So I started wearing my school because I couldn't see. I mean, I couldn't see without my glasses. It was extremely blurry. I mean, I still can't see without glasses. I mean, people ask me about the glasses I wear back then. I know they were real glasses. I said, yeah, you know, because I couldn't see. It was a struggle. I mean, it was a struggle back then because, you know, not having sports glasses. But when you wear your glasses, it was normal. But getting to the pros, it was no problem. I'd been wearing, you know, sports glasses, like really sports glasses. I think I got my first pair my junior senior year in high school. And so it made it better because, you know, they were durable. They were hard plastic. They could twist. They were ugly. They were black rim glasses. They looked like, you know, the Urkel glasses because they looked like back in those days.
Yeah.
But, you know, I wore them. And then when I got to college, that's when they the goggles, kind of, you know, the clear glide goggles, the clear, you know, the lenses were, you know, clear. So they looked a little bit better. But, I mean, my vision was always a problem. I mean, but it didn't hamper me because when I wear the glasses, it was hard to play in them. It was good in some ways because guys tried to poke me in the eyes and all that kind of stuff, and they couldn't poke me in the eyes because of the glasses. And then in 1982, when I tried the face mask that I wore from 82 all through my pro career with the open cage in the front. I mean, in a sense, I guess I made it popular because, you know, I was the first player. I don't know if somebody else wore it first, but it was a prototype. It was a prototype cage. And I won't forget the trainer brought it to me, Chip Roberts. I mean, Chip was still friends. He was a trainer at SMU, equipment trainer. He said, Eric, I got a cage I want you to try. And he showed it to me and I said, man, I like it the way it looks. And I just wore that because I didn't have that bar coming down the middle, down from the forehead down to the middle. And, you know, I wore glasses. And I mean, some people thought they were cool. They thought they were like I was high tech looking, but I wasn't trying to be high tech. Trust me. I couldn't see without those glasses.
There was really nothing high tech back in the day. Eric Dickerson joins me on the Rude Dog Show. There was kind of a myth going on because, and we'll get into it in a second, but you originally committed to Texas A&M, which I thought was really interesting because you had contenders in Oklahoma, Southern California, which obviously knows the Trojans, and then SMU. What was that conversation like with your great, great aunt like when she just basically convinced you, say, look, I love Coach Ron Meyer. How did that kind of change your mindset and your focus to want to play at SMU instead of?
Well, first, I mean, I did commit to A&M. I really want to go to A&M. I mean, one reason I didn't want to go to A&M, I didn't like it. It's funny, I'm telling kids, it's funny when you're a young kid, things that you don't like. I didn't like their uniforms. I didn't like their colors. I didn't like their mascot. And I didn't like it was mostly all boys. They had the yellies, no cheerleaders. I'm like, man, I don't want to go to a school like that. I mean, even though it was close to my hometown. Good school, don't get me wrong. A&M's a good school, but I didn't want to go there. But I did commit to them, but I didn't want to go. And so where I really wanted to go to school was Oklahoma, was OU. I mean, I wanted to go there very badly. And they're supposed to recruit me heavily. But that's the school my mother, I called my mom, Viola, she didn't want me to go. Matter of fact, when they came to recruit me, they came to my state championship game, and they came to my house, you know, like a couple of weeks later. And I committed to them. And I'll never forget, my mother was really quiet. Viola was real quiet when they were talking, and they were talking about this, and they were talking about that. And she also said, so what about the education part of it? And she said, oh, yeah, you know, he's going to graduate now. And she's like, yeah, because that was her thing. My mother was really, really smart. I mean, she was really smart in math. So anyway, when they left, I told them that I'm on the phone, Dallas. No. Hold on a second. I'm sorry.
That's okay. You're fine.
No. No. Go back upstairs. So I committed to A&M, and when they, I mean, at A&M, like OU, and when they left, I never get, they walked out. She said, "You ain't going to school there." I'm like, "Mama," she said, "Nope, Eric, you're not going to school there." She said, "That man's a liar, and I don't trust him." I'm like, "Oh," she talking about Coach Switz. So,
Oh.
man, I like, okay, so I had to call him, you know, get Mitch to tell him I wasn't going, I couldn't come. And you know, I wouldn't, at that point, I wasn't sure where I wanted to go. I mean, she wanted me to stay in Texas. She said, "You're a Texas boy." She said, "You need to go out of Oklahoma." She said, "I can't be flying." My mother had never flown. "I can't be flying no Oklahoma. I ain't never flown. I'm not flying no Oklahoma." So, you know, it was back to possibly A&M and SMU or Texas. I didn't like Texas. I didn't like the way they recruit, the recruiters, the way they recruited. You know, some of the stuff they would say to us as black kids, because they said some of the same things to me that said to other kids. That, you know, if you don't consider your state school when you come back to get a job, you won't be able to get a job in the state of Texas, which that didn't sit well with me, nor my mother. So anyway, SMU, I'm gonna run. Meyer came like a couple of weeks later, and I got all kind of letters from them. And well, first, I mean, I forgot. Let me just go back. USC, I came out. My first visit was to USC. I flew to Southern Cal, and come to, you know, go to the Trojans. And I went to the Rose Bowl game when they played Michigan. And I liked USC a lot. I mean, I like the whole thing about, I mean, the whole ambiance, just the dun, 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 dun. I like the, you know, the fight song and everything. But it was Southern California. I'm like, I'm from Sealy, Texas. I mean, I ain't about California. So, you know, I did. I just had to tell Coach Robinson. I said, "I like it, but it's just too far." And but I did. I enjoyed my trip. I enjoyed my trip to Southern Cal. Then, and then that's, I met with Coach Meyer. He came to my house. He came to my house. Talked to my mother, and I'm gonna tell you the way that Coach Meyer got me was he got my mom, because I really wasn't sure about SMU. I mean, I went on a trip there, but I just wasn't sure. I mean, it hadn't been a, it wasn't a big school with big tradition, winning tradition like a Oklahoma or USC or, you know, Nebraska or something like that. They just didn't have that. And I won't forget one of my mother said, she said, "Eric," she said, "school like that," she said, "Eric, you can be the first. You can go there and start something." I mean, SMU the one in the 30s and the 40s, but you know, I wasn't alive then, so I didn't know. And so when my Ron Meyer came, he see, you know, he's talking to my mother, and she said, he said, "Miss Dickens, you got anything to eat?" And she said, "Sure, come on in the kitchen." So he went in the kitchen, and he started having my mother cook. I think she had some chicken that she was gonna cook for me later, and they helped her cook chicken. And they talked, and you know, he's like, "Miss Dickerson, you know, I tell you, I make you a promise that if I ever have a problem with, if he comes to SMU, ever have a problem with him, I'll call you, and I'll make him a good man, a good man." And she, and I won't forget, he said, "One day I might even make him rich." You know, she laughed about that. She laughed about that. And so when he left, she was like, "I like him." She said, "That's why I want you to go to school." And I'm like, oh my gosh, because I didn't want to go to SMU. I'll make a long story short. That's why I ended up going, because she got Ron Meyer got my mother, got Viola.
Well, you put SMU on the map. I mean, let's face it, your efforts on the field, people were thinking SMU. Where the heck is SMU? Is this a
I know.
acronym for Southern Mule? I mean, what are we talking about? You put them on the map, and really, it was interesting. I was looking back at this a little bit, and I thought to myself, there's a trans A&M involved in this story somewhere, and that's at the like the tail end of it. Tell me about that. How did that come to be some type of mythological creature that you'd find in, you know, the closet when you're sleepy? Mommy, there's something in the closet. How did that
Well,
come to
people
be?
think, well, people think, that A&M bought me the Trans Am. I mean, the Trans Am, so I committed to Texas A&M. But the NCAA came to my house for a month, one solid month. They came to my school and my house and could not find anything that I had to be done wrong. Because one thing was, and I tell them my grandmother bought me the car. See, they were thinking Viola, my woman who raised me, my great great aunt. But that's not my grandmother. My grandfather lived in Houston. And my grandmother and grandfather, they could afford that car. And that's the thing. And they had the receipts. They had, you know, they had what they finance, you know, paid for it and everything. They had everything. You know, the money came out of checking account. So that was the reason they could not refute it. I mean, because they could afford it. So, and you know, people still said, you know, the A&M is the trans A&M, but you know, it wasn't like that. You know, and I, you know, I still got accused of it, but like I always say, my grandmother really did buy that car. They thought it was my mom. They thought that's who it was, wasn't her.
Well, they have that one backwards. They're going to have to correct that in the record books. I'll tell you, you shared carries with Craig James. Everybody knows who Craig James is. And Charles Wagoner. All you guys were basically all on the same team. Wagoner got hurt, and you and James basically had to lead the Pony Express. Why was it called the Pony Express? I know it had absolutely nothing to do with ponies or you guys riding down the field on pony. Well, how did you guys get dubbed the Pony Express?
Well, first it was a slogan they had, and it was called Mustang Mania when I first got to SMU. It was called the Mustang Mania. And Charles Wagner was a freshman. I was a freshman. Craig was a freshman. We had a slew of freshman running backs that came in that year. But I think Charles Wagner and Craig was probably more prepared for college football than I was, and I just have to admit that. I really wasn't. I was tall, lean. I never lifted weights before, so I didn't have that the bulk on my frame yet. And Charles was a good back. He came out of where did he come out of? Right there, he's right in Dallas. I can't think of the school, but he came right out right there out of Dallas. And my freshman year, Charles was good, really good. But he got hurt. We played Texas Tech Red Raiders. He went and he got broke a bone in his neck, and never played again. Because I'm gonna tell you. Somebody was going to have to leave. We couldn't survive there with all three of us. Somebody was leaving. And that guy was, at one point, was me, because I'd called Oklahoma to transfer after my freshman year. I'd called Oklahoma to transfer. I called to call Barry Switzer. And I made the call, you know, called zero and called, because there wasn't no cell phones back in those days. And got the operator, and I said, can you give me Oklahoma football? And they gave me the number, and I called. And I won't forget the lady, Oklahoma football. I said, can I have Coach Switzer, please? And she said, hold on a second. And they sent me to the scene. She said, Coach Switzer's secretary. So Coach Switzer's office, can I help you? And I said, is Coach Switzer in? And she said, he's not in. Who's calling? And I didn't say anything. She said, who's calling? And I just hung up. I said, I'm just going to wait till I get back to Sealy, because the season was over with. You know, school was about to end. So I was going to tell my mother when I got back I want to transfer. So when I got home, I told my mother, I said, Mom, I want to transfer. And she said, what? I said, I'd like to transfer. She said, boy, she said, I will never get her. And she said, sit your ass down. Let me talk to you. She said, she took a piece of paper and she put a line down the middle. And she put SMU on one side and put other. Not even a football team, other on it. She didn't put Oklahoma, she put other. She said, okay. She said, so tell me, why do you want to transfer? I gave her my reason. She said, okay. So do you have a scholarship at SMU? I said, yes, ma'am. As a check. Are you guaranteed a scholarship at OU? I said, well, she said, that's an X. She said, are you playing at SMU? Yeah, I'm playing. Okay, that's a check. Are you guaranteed you're going to play? Guaranteed. Well, then that's another X. So make a long story short, after she finished, it was all checks on SMU side, all X's on OU, on the other side. She said, boy, take your ass back to SMU. And so I went back to SMU.
Well, not only did you go back to SMU, you had 4,450 yards on 790 carries. You broke Earl Campbell's Southwest Conference record for yards and attempts, 48 career touchdowns, and tied Doak Walker. I mean, this guy's a legend. Doak Walker's a legend there. And then your senior year, even though you had to split time, with James, is you already knew you had already been playing with him at that point. You finished third in the Heisman voting. Man, what an amazing feat that was! And of course, not winning it's going to be like the most hurtful part of it. But you were in the conversation of a Heisman Trophy contact. I mean, that was the epitome at that point. Of course, you had other competition. You had Herschel Walker. Right, with the infamous Herschel Walker and John Elway.
He won it. Mm-hmm. John Elway, yeah. I mean, honestly, and I say this to this day, I was the best college football in the country that year player. I was the best player in the country. I mean, bar none. I mean, Look, I mean, I've never been braggadocious, but God gave me a talent second to no one's. My talent was that great, and he gave it to me. And when I look at, I had no push for the Heisman. They did no advertisement, none. When I say none, I'm talking about no advertisement. My advertisement was my play on the field, and I still came in third. Herschel, I won't get Herschel had 18. He had 1800 and something, like 1820 or something like that. And I had 16, I think 1617 or 1679. And John Elway, I forgot what John's numbers were, being a quarterback. But and Herschel had 100 more carries than I had. That I mean, I was he had 100 more carries, and I think he only had like 150 more yards than I had. And I'm like, how could he win the Heisman and I don't win the Heisman? And I averaged 7 yards to carry, had more touchdowns. So I was 17 touchdowns, splitting time. I think I carried the ball like 207 times that year. I mean, my numbers were, I mean, and I say I'm not bragging, but when I think about my college, especially my senior year, it was to be like a man playing with boys. That's how I felt. That's how I felt. You know, my body had developed, my speed. I was already fast. You know, I could cut on a dime, and my acceleration was just, it was phenomenal. Even for me, I was in awe of myself. Let's put it like that. What God had given me, and I was really happy, proud of it. But, you know, I always tell Herschel when I see him, I say, "You know, that's my Heisman you got." And he would laugh. You know, because really, Herschel's freshman year, he should have won the Heisman his freshman year. There was no doubt who's the best player in the country his freshman year. He should have won it. But, you know, they didn't want to give it to a freshman back then, especially a black kid. No doubt they wouldn't give it to a black kid in his freshman. No way that was going to happen. But, you know, I'm satisfied with just, you know, being in the conversation. But I still feel like that my senior year in college, I was the best player in the country. And we had the best football team in the country, too. We got screwed on that deal.
Well, SMU not being this big juggernaut that, you know, Coach Robinson was coaching down at SC, you know, Switzer and Oklahoma. You had powerhouses that were more, and of course, TV wasn't nowhere near as big as it is now, as far as from a media standpoint of what's being distributed and television deals worth millions and millions of dollars and things of that nature. Completely different dynamic. But you guys should have at least been recognized or a bowl bid to have to be in that part of that conversation.
Oh, we were. I mean, we came in second in the nation that year. We tied our last game against Arkansas, 17-17. We should have went for two. I don't know why the coaches did that. Ron Meyer would have been that. We'd have went for the win, but we ended up tying. We were second team. We were second in the nation behind, I think, Pitt. Pitt. Yeah, Pitt. We'd have beat Pitt. We'd have beat. I mean, we'd have, no, not Pitt. We'd have Penn State. We'd have beat Penn State. I mean, our team was so stacked. I mean, we had a stacked team, but I mean, it wasn't. It just it was. If we would have been Texas or USC, we were the only undefeated team that year. We ended up wound up 11-0-1. Won't forget, we were 11-0-1 with a tie. And we weren't playing no slide. We were playing Texas, A&M, Arkansas. That was a tough conference, very tough conference. Southwest Conference is a tough conference. But, you know, us being SMU, and I know they were probably happy we had that tie because, you know, that they had to because I think Penn State had a loss. We didn't have a loss. We were the only team without a loss. And, you know, we got stuck in, you know, that, you know, not being a big school.
Yeah. Size does matter when you're talking about schools, you know, in smaller conferences. Even though your Division I means nothing. If you're not on a big, large audience where scouts are visibly looking at what you're doing and what you're accomplishing on the field, they're just going to turn their head back. Okay, well, at least I showed up. There's no one to talk to, which was completely. Again, that's another time, a whole nother era altogether, literally. But you wanted to go to the LA Express, which I recall very briefly, United States football, USFL. Didn't quite go over very well. Didn't last long, obviously. But again, the National Football League was at that point the cream of the crop in regards to where talent really wanted to go. You were selected second overall in the 83 draft by the Los Angeles Rams. You blown away, blow the doors off. The jet was on fire. Whatever analogy you want to use, you established rookie records that still haven't been broken today. 390 rushing attempts, 1,808 rushing yards gained, and 18 rushing touchdowns, including two receiving. So you were off on the outside receiving those balls, which is kind of similar to what they do in today's NFL, right? They use guys like Le'Veon Bell on the outside. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a whole plethora of players, all pro, Pro Bowl, player of the year, rookie of the year honors, which I think you got basically stripped on for whatever reason. You should have won that rookie of the year award, but I digress. And then the second season.
I did win rookie of the year. I won rookie of the year.
Oh, you did? You won then?
Yeah, I won rookie of the year.
Oh, okay. Okay. I'm like, wait a minute, because you kind of got botched there. But no, you won that. So fair and square. I stand corrected. So then you continued this mega onslaught, being a member of the 2,000 yard club. You gained more than 100 yards rushing, breaking O.J. Simpson's previously held marker. You had 2,105 total rushing yards. And, of course, the year I was born, you decided to reach 2,007 yards, and I was like an infant, maybe a couple months old at that point. But but the NFL had went from 14 to 16 games in 78, so 5 years later, and then you had two additional games. And, of course, no one since, even to this day, has rushed for more yards in one NFL season. That's something that, at that point, we were talking from the beginning of the show, how you and OJ need to flip-flop as far as numbers for being ranked, at least as far as I'm concerned, on the NFL all-time list. But that's me. That's just me. That's what I think.
Well OJ's he's one of my favorites. I can say that. You know, he's my favorite player as a kid when I grew up. And I always say this, OJ did it in 14 games. I did it in 15. I had one extra game to go to get to 2,105. But you know, it's hard getting 2,000 yards. I mean, I came close my rookie season. I came close, I think my fourth year. I came close again. I think my fifth year. I came close a couple other times. But, man, it's really tough for me because back in those days, you know, I didn't really have a quarterback, never really had a, you know, it was on me. I saw a lot of 8-9-man fronts my whole career. And it would have been nice to see, like, a regular defense. You know?
Yeah, so, something more consistent, faking that handoff and have Terry Bradshaw maybe throw a dump over the middle or something, you know, to someone else. But, you know, again, the teams that you were on, and just like all other, you know, there's a lot of guys like Warren Moon, you know, didn't win the big one. He didn't have the type of receivers, but Warren Moon did things so magically on the field, just absolutely just mesmerizing, just completely mesmerizing. It almost reminds me of watching the young Lamar Jackson do it on the field. He was so elusive, you know, from being under center. And those two are really comparable, him and Michael Vick as well, also in that conversation. But something happened in 85 because there was this ongoing, I should be paid more. Rams didn't think so. So they decided to say, you know what? It's a shortened season in 87. Let's just trade you off to the Colts. And of course, that was the biggest blockbuster trade with, you know, other teams, other players, Cornelius Bennett going to the Bills. They give up their first round pick in 88, 89. They acquired Greg Bell and then three draft choices from Buffalo and their own first and second round in 88 and picking up Owen Gill for you. And I thought to myself, Owen Gill, and in all fairness, I don't even know who Owen Gill is from just the standpoint of his name. I'm sure he's a great guy and everything, but to basically give up the farm to get a pony, I just don't know how that quite worked out for them. And it didn't, obviously. I mean, Jerome Bettis also had the same similar contract dispute with them as well. He said, you know what, if you're not going to play me, trade me. No play, trade me. And that's exactly what happened. That was the best thing that could have ever happened to Jerome Bettis by getting sent from the Rams to trade for the Steelers. We all know how that turned out. But what did you, I mean, what were the finely tuned message that you wanted to give the Rams to say, look, I can still do this. Why not give me the opportunity? And why did they feel they needed to trade me?
Well, first of all, the Rams were, I was grossly underpaid. I mean, matter of fact, I just went back and looked at my contract. Here, I have a copy of all four of them, my 4 years I was the Rams, and I made $925,000 in 4 years, which is a joke. I mean,
some change.
Elway was the first pick. I was the second pick. John was making $1.5 million. I was making $150,000. I mean, say no more. Oh. Say no more. I mean, And the thing is, the media here made, because I was never a media guy. I didn't like the media. I just like, you know, doing my job. I would talk if I had to. That was not my thing. I never was that guy. But they crucified me. They made me this bad guy. I was an ingrate. I didn't know what ingrate was. I never heard of ingrate. You know, I was ingrate. I was a malcontent. I didn't know what a malcontent was. I was a locker room lawyer, which I was none of those things. Man, I played football, went home, and that was it. And chased girls back in those. That was it. And my mother, she hated football. She hated that sport. She said, "I hate that sport. I hate you play it." She said, "You know, I hate you ever showed them your talent." She said, "But you know, my mother, you know, we didn't come from a lot of money." But she said, "I know you're not getting paid right," and I wasn't. I mean, I won't forget. This was a couple of weeks ago. I asked Richard Dent, my friend Richard Dent. I said, "Richard, I seen your fourth year. How much money were you making your fourth year?" He said, "Well, I think I," he said, "base I was making, I think he said base he was making, I think 900. He said, "I with the bonus, I think I made $1.4 million, like $1.2 million, something like that, $1 million." He said, "I said, you know how much I was making my fourth year?" I said, "I was making," and I went for 1,800 a year. I was making $400,000. I mean, I was a 52nd highest paid player in the league. I mean, that's just how bad it was with the Rams. I mean, it was bad. See, people, they don't know that. I mean, they make all these assumptions, and when you're funny, when you talk about assumptions, and you know, I always judge a person's on personal how when I meet them, not on what someone else says when I meet them, because they made me out to be a bad, bad guy. I mean, I was just this bad guy nobody liked, and you know, and we had such a close knit team, man. We were so close. Mm-hmm. But you know, I mean, and I said John Shaw messed our team up. He really did. He destroyed that team. You know, because John was a numbers guy. He wasn't a football guy. He missed it. I mean, he admitted it. You know, he was a numbers guy. He was, you know, making sure that Georgia was taken care of, and it was about the numbers. And the Rams didn't have a lot of money. And I didn't know that. You know, I just want to get paid right. That was it. I'm like, and it just never worked out. I mean, at one point, I had a meeting with him after my fourth year. I said, "John," I said, "you know, I got to get paid more than this." And it's Eric. He said, "You know, you have a new contract." I said, "No." I said, "Man, this contract ain't, it's no good. You know it's no good." And I said, "I tell you what, this is, you tell me this ain't a great deal." I said, "I tell you what." I said, "I am so confident in my ability." And I didn't know what the number was going to be. I said, "If you give me what John Elway makes," and I think John Elway was making $1.5 million at that point. I said, "And if I rush over, let's just say 1,300 to 1,400 yards," which I knew I would do, "I will keep that contract. If not, I'll go back to my old contract." He said, thought of it, said, "No, I'm not going to do that." So, right. I mean, I'd say, I at that point, I was willing to go year by year. This year, like this year by year. I'll take it year by year. Not even a long, like a 3 or 4 year deal. He said, "No, we're not going to do that." So that's when I knew that it was going to happen. It just wasn't going to work with the Rams. And it got uglier and uglier. And came to the point where, I mean, my head coach John Robinson was making more money than me, and that's when I said, "If you let John Robinson run 47 gap, he makes more money than I do," which in a sense was true. I mean, seriously,
right.
And then it just got bad, and I won't forget the last carrot I had for the Rams. I played the Cleveland Browns in Cleveland. I told John, I said, "I'm not gonna play." He said, "Well, if you're not gonna play, we're gonna suspend you." And I said, "Okay." I said, "Well, of course, my thigh was hurt. I had a thigh bruise. It wasn't really bad thigh bruise, but I could play. I said, "Well, I don't want to start." I said, "I'll play, but I don't want to see the Charlie stuck in my thigh. I got a thigh bruise." And so we played in Cleveland that night, a Monday night football game. And man, I was on the bench. I sat on the bench for like the first quarter. And Charlie got hurt for something. How he got hurt. And they need me to go in the game. I'm like, damn, I didn't plan on playing. I grabbed my helmet, around the field. I think the very first play might have been a pass play. And that was incomplete. The next play, they ran the football. They got, you know, caught me in the backfield. And, you know, the crowd was cheering and booing and all that kind of stuff. We were in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. And the next play, boom, I think it was like a 45-yard touchdown run. And I left and I came off the field. I said, "My thigh's hurting." I said, "I'm through." I said, "I can't run no more." Even though I could have ran some more, but I will never forget my reply. And when I couldn't, in my mind, I'm like, F them. I said, "I just want to show them how good I am." I said, "Fuck them. I'm not going to hurt myself or this team anymore." And I was just done with them. And then on Halloween, I got traded October 31st, 1987.
Yeah, there, you know, when you look back at it, it's one of those cloudy, almost an unspoken time, you know, where you just rather put it behind you and say, you know what, it doesn't matter anymore. It's done and over with. But ultimately, it really affected the relationship. It had affected you wanting to play, the desire to play. And now you're taking football and you're taking the fun and you're deflating it from in my hands. Now a ball that, you know, had so many ounces of air in it now is deflated in my hands. What do you want me to do with it? How do you want me to proceed with a flattened ball? Because now you flattened me. You flattened any upside curve that we would have had had you've actually paid me what I was worth. Just an analogy, want to throw that out there. They went ahead and traded you over the Colts. And you blew the doors off Alan Ameche, to be quite honest with you, because now you're the franchise leader in rushing. And that was back in 55. And of course, 55 was another era, a different time. They didn't really wear helmets that were designed to protect players and things of that nature. So you basically, you know, gained 1,311 yards in 89. You passed the 10,000 yard marker in 91 games. You were up there with guys like Jim Brown, the great Barry Sanders, Emmitt Smith, and of course, LT. You had done it in seven straight seasons, so the new NFL record. And because Tony Dorsett had retired, I met Tony Dorsett. What a class act guy he is. Of course, he played for Pitt at the end of 88. Active leader in career rushing yards until he decided to retire in 93. And I can't say that I blame him. He did everything that he possibly could for his football team. But all of those, you being 29 years old, being the highest paid running back in the NFL, finally receiving those types of accolades, how did you feel at that point, knowing that the reported salary was your 1.4 that John Elway was making at least years earlier?
You know, I was pleased with that, but I'll say this much: I didn't have the love of football after I left LA like I did. I played hard, all the time. Never not play hard, even when I was unhappy with the Rams. I never not play hard, but I didn't love it like I loved it. I used to love everything about football. Smell it. I could tell the smell of the air. I just love practice, everything about it. But I didn't have that same love for it anymore. And, you know, it was a hurt feeling because I was a player that I would give you a 150%. I mean, I can think of times when we played the Jets, and I think I carried the ball 30 times. And then I think next we played the Lions, I carried 32 times. I mean, I carried third back-to-back. I mean, played the Bears 27 times. I mean, I was that guy. I mean, I carried, I think, my rookie season, I carried 390 times and had 46 receptions. My second year, I think I carried 404 times. I mean, they don't do that anymore. I mean, but I was that guy. I mean, I played hurt lots of times, where one of the guys today, they wouldn't even play. I played with broke hands. You know, but that was the kind of player I was. I mean, I loved playing with my coach. We had a close team. I didn't want to let my team down, but I just felt my team, my organization let me down, you know, for what I was what all of us trying to accomplish. And we still believe this. If I wouldn't have got traded, that team, they'd kept that team together when they finally got Jim Everett. We'd have won a Super Bowl in LA, but they were too short-sighted to see it. I mean, and that's what it's all about, was winning. You win in L.A., it's like winning in any other city. It's like the Dodgers winning here and the Lakers. I mean, that's what makes them great, because this is Hollywood. I mean, you do it here, you do it. I mean, this is what you want to be. I mean, this is what you think of. You don't think of, you know, Hollywood in Pittsburgh. You don't think of Hollywood in San Francisco. You don't think of Hollywood in New York. This is Hollywood. This is the hills, the beautiful women, the sunset, the ocean, everything here. But, you know, like I said, I still love football, but I just didn't have that undesiring passion that I used to have for it at all. I mean, and that our team was not even close as near as the team that we had here in LA, not even close. I mean, we had a lot of jealous players on that team. And I never seen that before in football. In high school, we had a close team. College, we had a close-knit team. When I got to the Rams, we had a close-knit team. And when I got to Indianapolis, I finally saw, when people talk about guys are envious and jealous of other players, I saw it. I saw it there. It was very dysfunctional. And I give Ron Meyer credit for trying to keep it together as long as he could, because, you know, that team, it was just guys on that team that were just when you're talking about a malcontent or cancer of a football team, I saw it up close. Guys who didn't care, you know, because my thing was, I hated losing. I could not stand it. It was the worst thing of all playing a sport like football. You get beat the hell up, and then you go out and lose, and guys not giving 100%. I think that was some of the most frustrating parts of being there on that football team with players that you knew that just they were there for all the wrong reasons. But, you know, it was a sport that has been good to me. Football was good to me. It gave me things that I would have never been able to do. Bless my family. Bless my mom before she passed away. I thank God for my ability. And he gave it to me. I mean, it was a gift that he gave me. And man, when I tell you, wow, it was some kind of gift, because when I look at some of my tapes and highlights and how I could run and cut, man, it's just like amazing. Because even now, I mean, and I'm, like I said, I'm not bragging, but you're not gonna find a guy that's my size, 6'3", 225, could run a 4.340. I ran a 20.6200, won a state in 100 in Texas and 200. And as a football player, not just a track man, I played football as a football player, cut like I could. And, you know, it's just, they don't come around every day. I mean, and like I say, I just thank God that I had an opportunity to play pro football, college football, high school football. And I thank him for the gift that he gave me. And then I cherished it, you know, when I had it. And now I'm almost 60 years old, that gift is gone. So, you know, I look at my son, he's 8, and man, and I told my friend when he was about 3, my son was 4. I said, if he plays football, I said, he's going to be better than his dad. I can see it already. He plays flag with me. He's phenomenal. I mean, he really is. And I'm not saying he's going to play professional, but the stuff he can do is just like, wow, you know, the stuff he could do with, and being as young as he was on playing with older kids. And I just pray to God that in this era, if he plays sports, that he doesn't have the racial things that happened to me happen to him. You don't have to, go through that. Go through those trials and tribulations that his dad went through, you know, of not being treated right, you know, of being, you know, scorned, of being called a bad guy and a malcontent just because of I want to be treated right, paid right. And there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, I was taught by my mother, Viola Dickerson, you stand up for what you believe is right. And that's how I've always done that. I'm never going to stand up for wrong. I don't care if it's a black guy, so they're doing something wrong and the white guys are doing right. I gotta go with the guys who are doing right. I mean, that's just how I look at it. And that is my life. I thank God for it. And I thank God for allowing me to play a sport like football through all the bumps and bruises. And I'm beat the hell up. I can tell you that.
I'm sure you are.
Yeah, I'm beat the hell up.
I'm sure after all those years of hits and pull downs and, you know, things that ultimately just causes, you know, injury, horse collar tackles and things of that nature, really had everything to do with getting beat up. But what's not so beat up is the fact that your birthday is just in a couple of days. And mine's coming up as well, to be quite honest with you.
Happy birthday.
I was born on 9/11. Likewise, happy birthday to you. To go back to the Colts for half a minute, they really tanked. When I say tank, they were the epitome of tanking. And I think you're talking about the mentality, attitude of the organization, the attitude of the players, and they really were reflected of one another. And you look at the 536 yards you ran that season, they tanked like Atlantis in the bottom of the ocean, 1-15. 1-15. I can't even fathom 1-15. That's insane. But teams still do it nowadays. If they feel that their season is not going all that well, the Cleveland Browns are noted for, you can have the arguments to say that they actually did it or they didn't do it, but it's just a few years ago. Outside of today, they actually found a way to tank and in turn acquire those players in today's NFL, which again, everything looks great on paper, but without actual wins versus losses and those wins favoring you, the losses don't really mean much unless you're planning on losing. And at that point, you may as well just forget it and start firing people and call it a day. Eric Dickerson joins me here on the Rude Dog Show. I'm Rudy Reyes. We're going to wrap it up here in a moment. But I want to talk about that final trade in April of 92 for a fourth and eighth round pick. At least you were getting, you know, sent some type of positive message. Hey, you're going to give two picks for me? Wow, I'm good with that. There were flashes of greatness on the field. You still had some shiftiness to you. You still had bursts of speed. You had 107 yards against the Broncos, 103 against the Chargers. and then your 63rd and 64th career 100-yard game, but that soon ended. You scored a 40-yard touchdown run, and of course, you can look back at the flashes of brilliance that you had on the field, and that was certainly indicative of what I had seen on Monday Night Football against the Kansas City Chiefs, who just won a Super Bowl 54, down in Miami, of course, prior to COVID, kind of setting the groundwork for things to follow and things to come. But then the following season, you're traded to the Falcons for a 6th-round draft pick. You played in a backup role, obviously, against the Steelers in September. Of course, not a great belated birthday present in a losing effort, but needless to say, you were traded from Bruce Pickens. I don't even know who that is. Green Bay Packers. And of course, John Stevens on October 13th of 93. And ultimately, the reason that Jerry Glanville decided to cut you loose was because he wanted to use younger players. Now, that is a professional bias, and you can have that claim. No one wants a 50-year-old guy playing on a roster or running back position. I mean, the guy could barely get up from the bench, you know, much less put a uniform on and a helmet. What was it about knowing that Jerry Glanville decided to just cut ties with you, and in turn, you're signing that one-day contract in August 29th of 2017 of the Rams ultimately retire?
Well, it wasn't even a cut. It was mutually agreed, really, because when I got to Atlanta, I'd gotten hurt with the Raiders, and they never told me how serious my injury was, and I didn't even know. I knew something wasn't right. I hurt my neck, and when I got to Atlanta, the doctor there kind of gave me an indication that I probably shouldn't be playing. But he didn't come out and just say it, because back in those days, they hid everything. They didn't tell you how hurt you were. So I went to my own independent doctor, and I won't forget, after I had the physical at Green Bay, and the guy told me, he said that if I didn't stop playing football, he said, it's not a matter of if, it was a matter of when. He said, you're going to get paralyzed from the neck down, or you're going to die on the field. And he showed me the MRI, looking at my MRI, and that was it. It was nothing else to be said, and I was done. And, you know, like I said, not knowing, because I knew something wasn't right, because I had the numbness in my hand, my arm, down my neck, and I would be dizzy at times. So, like I said, this just goes to show how the teams hide stuff. Even at your health, you know, they don't, and I would say to them, they don't care about you. They don't. You're just a commodity to them. Mm-hmm. And back, especially back in those times, I mean, and I could have really ended up getting killed on that field. But, you know, if you can score touchdowns, a possibly still run, that's all they care about. And so at that point, when the doctor told me that, I was done. And, you know, like I said, football was good to me for the time I played it, and I was good to it. But do I miss it? Absolutely not. Not even a little bit.
but with that comes the understanding, though. You know where you've been, and you understand how that goes. You're just talking about your son, who's 8. You can see the glimpse of what a genetic code can do, and that's something he may or may not want to pursue as he gets older. And if he was even amassed the type of numbers, and I'm going to give everybody this general perspective on this. This is Eric Dickerson joining me on the Root Dog Show. Hall of Famer, I might add, and deservedly so. 7th back to gain more than 10,000 yards, fastest to ever do it. No one's come close. Not yet.
Nope.
Could happen, but not yet. 11-year career, he gained 13,259 yards rushing. 2nd all-time. Rushed for 90 touchdowns, gained 2,137 yards and 6 touchdowns on 281 pass receptions. That is mind-blowing. That's absolutely blowing the doors off of a car. 6-time Pro Bowl selection, not one, count it up. 6-time Pro Bowl selection, All-Pro in 83, 84, 86, 87, 88. And then first-year eligibility. Some players don't even get in on the first-year eligibility. That's just the bottom line. And there's still a lot of players in the NFL that are still waiting to get in. Still waiting to get in. Will they ever?
Yep.
I don't know. Drew Pearson just got a nod. Maybe he'll get in. Bill Nunn Jr., posthumously, is going to get in. He's the architect of the steel curtain. How do you not put this guy in there? And of course, when you look at 99, if anybody has a copy of this laying around somewhere, Sporting News 100 greatest football players, you rank 38, justifiably so. I think that number, again, should be flipped as the NFL ranks you below the great O.J. Simpson in a football capacity. And then you were decided to go into broadcast. What were your thoughts being on that side of the camera? Because we talked earlier, you weren't into media. You didn't care about media. It wasn't your thing. What made you want to pursue that career, obviously, other than the football knowledge that you had retained while being a player?
I was asked to do it, basically. Long story short, I was asked to do it. And, you know, I did Monday night. I was terrible at that. But I work for Fox. I do Undisputed with Skip and Shannon. I have a radio show that I do on Mondays, called Football Mondays. I don't know if it's going to be football this year, but it's Football Mondays.
Yeah.
With Rogan and Rodney. So, you know, we'll see. You know, we'll see. But, you know, the media thing is, I'm a guy, I tell the truth. I mean, I don't pull any punches. I'm not the guy that's trying to make anybody look bad. But if you ask me a question, and the same thing when I play football, if you ask me, make sure you want the real answer, because I'm gonna tell you what I think. I mean, and, you know, they make some guys, this day and age, you know, guy play a couple of games, and somebody, he's a great one. You know, I don't buy into that. You know, I can tell a guy's gonna be a great player pretty quickly, but, you know, they'll say it because he has a couple of good games, and that doesn't make a guy a great player. You can say he had a great game, but that don't make him a great player.
Right. Yeah. You have to encompass all of those things, right? We talk about defensive player of the year, offensive player of the year. We talk about MVP. I think those qualities really need to be inflective of who the person is and what they've done, not only on the field, and that's great and wonderful, but what do they do off the field? How are they contributing to their community? How do they take care of other people? How do they give back? And I think that your perfect exemplary fact of that. And for those that don't know, 99, you're elected in Pro Football Hall of Fame. And then in 2020, just this year, in fact, elected to the College Football Hall of Fame. Finally, what was it like having those roles reversed, even though you'd broken SMU numbers, to finally be elected to the College Football Hall of Fame?
It was good. I mean, I knew what took so long. They put that SMU scandal on me and Craig in our class, and we had nothing to do with it. But, you know, it's always, it was good. You know, the thing is that when you get to be my age, you know, any kind of accolades you get from football, I guess, is a blessing. But, you know, I thank God for it, for sure. And I mean, my numbers speak for themselves. And I'm glad I got a chance to play at my university, Southern Methodist University.
Well, thank you, Eric. Thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it. This has been an interview in the making, so I want to thank you for your time. Ran a little bit over, but nonetheless, you're used to talking. You have a show. You're on with Fred Rogan. I mean, and I met Fred, a really nice guy, and he asked me when I walked in there one time to the LA station there, and he says, "And you want to work in broadcast?" And I said, "Yeah, I want to work in broadcast." Of course, it came a little bit later than I would like, but nevertheless, here I am. This is Rudy Reyes on the Rude Dog Show. Eric, thank you so much. Where can people reach out to you, listen to your show, and how can they kind of, get connected with you?
I'm sorry, I can't hear what you say now.
Oh, where can people follow you and connect with you? I know you're big on Twitter, and you post very uplifting messages on Twitter every Sunday, which I always find a way to retweet. with almost 500,000 tweets, I must say, on there. But how else can people find you?
They can find us through our website on youngwarriors.org. You know, because we have our foundation mostly. But you know, I'm gonna say this much for me. Mostly, I'm pretty private. You know, I just try to stay under the radar, do my job. You know, spend time with my family, and my kids right now, and you know, especially in these times, this COVID stuff going on, but. You know, if you see me, you know, I'm always a guy that's willing to take a picture, sign an autograph. You know, that's me. But, you know, the social media stuff, I'm on Twitter a little bit, but I don't get on some Instagram, but not a lot. You know, my stuff is, I try to keep most of it kind of private, but that's me.
Well, there you go. That's it. Eric, thank you so much for coming on. And I'd love to do this again as the season progresses. Granted, there is an NFL season. I'm not saying there isn't, but when there's a season that happens and no one's in a bubble and they can't be touched, I'd love to have you come back on the show.
No problem. We have a season for sure. Contact me. I'll come back on for you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate
okay.
that.
All right. Okay,
thanks, Eric. Take care.
Okay.
Thanks for coming on.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. That was fantastic. I love having Eric Dickerson on. He is an absolute delight. Love talking to him. He's straightforward. He tells it like it is. And I can certainly appreciate that because I do as well. I'm Rudy Reyes on The Rude Dog Show. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. And catch this on Apple Podcasts. And it will be everywhere, including therudedogshow.com. Follow me at Rude Dog Reyes. And throw me a follow on Instagram as well. Thanks a lot for tuning in.